You want to think about where that money that you're expending for your food is going to end up. I actually think that it's scandalous that we appear to brag about how little we pay out of our disposable income for food. It oscillates right now between 8 and 10%. And that to me is no bragging matter. That is essentially saying we're going to cut out as many costs as possible. We're going to externalize polluting the environment. We're going to externalize paying as little as we can to farm workers. We're going to exploit immigrant farm workers. We're going to do everything we can to cut corners to build up the balance sheet. So I don't want to be a part of that kind of food system. I want to pay a fair price for what I'm eating if I know that it's going to go to keep a family on a farm, that it's going to go to provide dignified livelihood to workers, and it's going to go to clean water, clean air, and building up soil.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, if you say you're not concerned today, it's to say you're not really paying attention. My guest today is paying attention, and his organization's middle name is Concerned. I'm happy to welcome Ricardo Salvador, the Director of Food and Environment with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Ricardo, welcome.
Thank you very much, Roger. It's good to be with you.
I didn't jump ahead too much, did I, to say that you might count yourself in the concerned camp too?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, very well put.
Well, and I get to think about that. There's a lot of associations that maybe wish they could rename themselves like your organization and saying they put concerned as their middle name too. Although I think to many people right now, they'd rather have a different verb. I think maybe panicked or frightened, you know, alarmed, motivated, concerned is almost somewhat passive. At the time you started with your organization, that was probably fairly radical to say that these scientists could be concerned. But
yeah, true. That was 1970. Yeah, we just celebrated 51 years.
Yeah. Well, Ricardo, looking at when you look at food and environment, to me, the space that you're covering is so broad. There's so much going on right now. I think another metaphor comes to my mind is now we have fires all over the state of California, and if we had a really tall enough tower, we could see these fires all over the place. And from your vantage point, you have another kind of fires that are going on in food and agriculture, and you're looking at the scale of what's happening, of how food is being produced, how it's being processed, how people in the food system are treated, safety issues, and a broad range. So from your vantage point and looking at all this, what are some of the things that are high on your list to be concerned about?
Well, that is an excellent question because it's a controversial question. The answer that you get depends on where you sit in the food system. And that's one of the reasons why this is a complicated world. My top answer to that is that this is a system that just plain is not functioning. And let me justify that, because to most people who aren't acquainted with the inside of the food system, that's a nonsensical statement, because we all experience the food system as providing abundantly. And not only that, providing abundantly just about anything that we imagine, almost anything that we ask of it. If there's ever been any question about it, it's only come up in the context of some of the disruptions that we've experienced since the pandemic started, when things that we take for granted all of a sudden fell apart. So the reason why I can claim that it is not functioning, even though it appears that the throughput and the productivity and the efficiency are high, is that these come not only at a high cost, but in many cases at an unaccounted cost. Probably the best way to express that simply is that without exploiting people and without exploiting nature, then the system as we know it right now, the business models that are utilized in the business throughout the entire value chain, which, as you know, and most of your listeners likely know, is not any single company. It's thousands of companies performing each of the components of the value chain, exchanging products with one another in both directions, you know, exchanging products for inputs for production and then exchanging finished products to go on up the value chain. So what happens with this system at present time is that food production is almost an incidental part of it. It's kind of like a byproduct. The main product is the profit for the companies that are involved. And as with other areas of our economy, agriculture is not isolated. We're experiencing a phenomenon where that wealth is being transferred in one direction, where it's being concentrated in massive, consolidated agribusinesses. And so when I say that the system is not working, what I'm seeing is a system that is polluting. I'm seeing a system that is exploiting people. I'm seeing a system that is making nourishing food unaffordable for certain people. I'm seeing the people that is actually redistributing wealth and concentrating it in very small corners of the economy. And so the things that may appear to be working smoothly don't look as nicely when you look under the cover. And to me, it's important to point out that this is not the only configuration of the food system that there can be. I can imagine, and I know that many other people can imagine, and probably all of us would be willing to work hard for a system that does produce the reliable food supply that we've all been accustomed to, not only not exploiting people, but helping everybody in the value chain thrive in a way that's commensurate with their contribution to the value of their part of the value chain. And also a system that doesn't exploit nature, that doesn't create pollution, doesn't degrade soil, but actually rebuilds it, that helps to purify water, doesn't pollute it, that cleans air rather than pollute it, that doesn't emit greenhouse gases. All of these things are within the realm of both physical science, biological science, agricultural science, economic science. So they're possible. It's just a matter of the choices that we're making. So those are the things that, that concern me. And I'm sorry to be windy about that, but I think it's really important for folks that think it's incongruous to look at all the shiny fruit in grocery stores and think that this is all splendid, to learn that there are people that are worried about the backside of the food system. So I need to explain why that is.
You know, this reminds me that in the last few days, I saw a story that said that if you looked at the United States and compared it to other countries in the world, we tend to think that we're number one in, as far as quality of life, incomes, life expectancy, I don't know, general happiness, opportunities for you send kids to college and so forth. But in fact, they said we were ranked 28th. So we're 28th in the world, and a lot of them seem like many of the best ones were in Scandinavia, and maybe Japan and Taiwan and a couple other places. But there was we're 28th. Now it made me think, Ricardo, could we do the same thing when it comes to food and agriculture? I mean, would we see countries that are doing better than us as a country, that have a food system that checks more of the boxes that you've just described than we do currently in the United States?
Yeah, that is a very reasonable question to ask. And I can't name a country like that, but there's an explanation for that. The reason is that since the post-war era, the agricultural model that has been developed in the United States, in essence, has been exported to other parts of the world. It would only be a slight exaggeration to say that elsewhere, people are falling all over themselves to try to replicate the food and agricultural model of the United States. And again, while that may seem to be a positive, if what you're trying to replicate is the high productivity of the system, that needs to be evaluated in the full understanding of what it is that actually makes the system productive in the United States compared against whether those same factors exist elsewhere, and also the unaccounted costs. That's not a metaphor. There are costs that are literally kept off the books when we talk about how efficient the agricultural and food system is. So to the extent that what people are looking at when they try to replicate the American model of the food system, that they say, I want that profitability without taking into account that it comes with all of the ills that I just listed for you, then this has not been a good phenomenon. But that explains why it is that the same kinds of ills that we talk about when we critique the U.S. agricultural model have been replicated elsewhere. We literally are existing at a time when that model is basically obliterating any other way of thinking about agriculture. And, you know, it's a product of the educational system that we're also exporting from the United States, among other things. It's a product of the policy infrastructure that the United States has set up to support the agribusinesses that are at the top of the food and agriculture pyramid in the United States, that then folks make an effort to either replicate in other parts of the world, or that these same agribusinesses essentially just extend to other parts of the world, because of course these agribusinesses are global. To them, the United States is just one of the basins from which they gather the inputs for the stuff that they sell at high value add. So they look at the seven different agricultural basins around the planet as basically the interchangeable spots from which they get their inputs. And they are more powerful than governments. They're able to impose the policies that they want that are favorable to them in different parts of the globe. So that's one of the reasons why you really can't look around the globe and find one place that's been isolated from the influences that have made what might have been a different agricultural destiny in the United States and chosen a different path. So those degrees of freedom just haven't been there.
You know, Ricardo, I remember meeting you perhaps for the first time at an event in San Francisco. And in the upstairs of the Ferry Building in San Francisco, for people that know that, there was, you came, and I can't remember the group that, is it Cuesa, C-U-E-S-A or something? And there was an interesting panel, and I recall your bringing up the fact that there are many people throughout the Midwest in particular that had been expanding, getting bigger and bigger equipment. And you were forecasting that they would start trying to reverse if they could, that there was a trend of right-sizing on the horizon. Well, we're now at that horizon. Has that in fact happened? Because it was, I don't know, maybe 5-7 years ago or something that you were talking about that. Has that prediction come true in your mind?
Well, it would be overstating to say that it's actually a trend, but it is accurate that a lot of people throughout agriculture, and specifically if you're talking about farms, that a lot of people in farms are asking themselves the question, how can I get off this treadmill? This is basically a no-win situation if you're a farmer. One of the reasons is what I just described right now. The profit centers in food and agriculture, you know, anybody who knows anything about economics would predict who they are. And this is basically the manufacturers and distributors. In other words, the tail end of the value chain. That's where you've got the greatest value add. Farmers are almost at the opposite end of that. The only thing that's further than they are at the opposite end of the value chain would be the farm labor. But farmers themselves are seen by the industry, the food manufacturers, as essentially the folks that generate inputs. The inputs that they provide, which are basically the livestock, the grain, the commodities, and so on, go on their ledgers in exactly the same way that the cardboard for the boxes or the plastic for the packaging or the refrigerant, you know, for the cooling systems and so on. They're just input costs. And they'll look for the lowest source of those and they'll get it in any part of the world that they can. They'll play off, you know, American wheat against Argentine wheat any day that you want, or, you know, American corn against Chinese corn any day that you want. They play globally. They care very little about national, you know, allegiances, and they care even less, don't even see the farmers. So they may sound like a very rough thing to say, but these are laws of that business. So if you, this will take a little bit to lay out, so be patient with me, because often by not getting at the nuances, you know, it sounds like we're just making these really crass statements without backing them up. So when you look at the structure of the agricultural system, what you see is that you have farmers that see that they have essentially two choices about how they're going to produce. Either they're going to play the low-value commodity game, which means that they need very large extensions in order to be able to cash flow, or else they will find some very high cash value crop on which they can make a living on small acres. So, you know, for the longest time, the joke was that the highest value cash crop in the entire United States was marijuana. And it's no longer such a joke. Now, you know, it's actually out in the open economy, particularly in your state. But there are lots of crops like that that people look to. So, for instance, Midwestern farmers, you should see the way that their eyes bulge out when they're accustomed that a good year might be something like $200, $300 an acre of profit when they hear that a tomato farmer in California might consider $10,000 an acre to be a middling year. So the poverty of the imagination that there is only those two scenarios that you can work with is more or less the structure within which farmers operate at the moment. Now, this is generalizing very, very broadly. But for farmers that are stuck in that low value, high volume type of paradigm, they actually think that they're, or I should rephrase that, it isn't that they think it, it's that their reality is that their agricultural system around them is so specialized that they don't really have sufficient power or degrees of freedom to change that system. The system is more powerful than they are. So think about the cash flows in that system. So if the market works, what it's rewarding is basically the technology packages that modern farmers have chosen. These days, you buy a package which is the seed and the herbicide. If you're farming at high scale, and that means that you need machinery to allow you to get into the field quickly during planting. And, you know, just so it's explicit to people that aren't familiar with the farming operation, if you've got thousands of acres and you've got a week or two window to get your corn and your beans in the Midwest, you need some pretty high-tech machinery to be able to move through that many acres relatively quickly.
Right.
And the same thing happens at the other end of the season. So all of this is technology that is very, very expensive that needs to be paid back by those 2,000, 3,000, 10,000 acres, whatever it is that's needed in order to be able to cover those expenses. Well, that's if that agricultural economy worked. The value of corn in particular is so low that it doesn't work, that in most years you actually need to have government support in order for that system to actually cash flow. So if you look at the structure of that system, the dollars are flowing to the people that are selling the inputs, the people that are selling the seeds, the chemical fertilizers, the machinery, and so on. They just flow through farmers. They don't stay with the farmers. And those these days are a small number of companies, and they tend to be global companies. So the money that goes through farmers is not staying in their communities. It's going to the headquarters offices of these companies in Geneva, in Chicago, New York, in China, wherever they might happen to be located, Brazil, some of them. So when you look at that system, there's something that emerges around it, which is that the farmers themselves are essentially playing the role of absorbing the risk that comes with farming outdoors. You make all of those expenditures, which on the low end can be thousands, and depending on the crop. So for instance, in California, there are crops that will cost millions to put into the field. So you take the risk of planting those crops and then losing them in a flood, in a 10-second hailstorm, you know, or some other so-called act of God. So the farmers are playing the role of in taking the risk of making those investments, exposing themselves to potential losses, and the industry takes the benefit of having sold the inputs no matter what happens. The industry has a solid market, those farmers that need to get their crops in the field. And then the folks that buy from farmers have an assured market that's steady, that's dependable, because no matter what goes wrong any given year, if you're in commodity programs, the government will make sure that you're whole. So the government is essentially backing up the business model of both the input sector and the buying and manufacturing sector. Those are the major beneficiaries. They essentially have a business model that says nothing can go wrong. This is going to be a stable, reliable market both for selling into and buying from, because it's backed by the good faith and trust of the U.S. Treasury. So when you talk about that as farming, you're not really capturing the way that the system works. The farmers are essentially the chumps of the system, not because they're not intelligent people, not because they're not entrepreneurial, but the structure of that system basically gives them few choices. They're there to accept that risk. Mm. Now, you realize that I'm generalizing broadly here, which is one of the problems about talking about agriculture. Any statement that you make, you'll always be able to say, oh, well, there's this exception. You know, there is no single model of what a farmer is. But it is those folks that, now finally to answer your question, it is those folks that are asking themselves, how can I get out of this treadmill, out of this system? Yeah. And so what they're asking themselves is, I need to retain more money. And if my role is basically that I'm the tractor driver, or if, for instance, if they're not in commodity grain production, if they're in livestock production and they've got a contract, you know, they work at a CAFO, say in poultry, for instance, then essentially they're loading up the feed. They're making sure that the thermostats are working. They're making sure that the cycle of production of the livestock species is not disrupted. So essentially they're hired labor. You know, they're not receiving the wages of an entrepreneur because they're not functioning as an entrepreneur. And so something that would surprise most people that are not in agriculture is to know that there are very few farmers that actually make enough money out of farming that they can live off of farming. The majority of farmers actually subsidize their income from an off-farm job. Actually, the statistics are fairly stark on that. Most people will go with a government statistic that says that there are a little bit over 2 million farms in the nation, and equate that with a little bit over 2 million farmers. Well, if you just constrain that definition of a farmer by asking how many of those folks are actually in it to make a living and making a living from what they're producing, you chop that number down pretty directly to about 300,000 people. And you can even chop that number further by asking what proportion of those farmers are actually generating the majority of agricultural output in the United States. Calling that output is a very deliberate thing to do. Not all of what they generate is food. So it turns out that something like about maybe 70,000 farmers are churning out about 75% of the agricultural output of the United States. So the majority of farmers are not making it in agriculture. That's what I mean when I say the system is not working.
A depressing perspective. But still, it's a sad state of affairs when you narrow it down to that much. And I'm surprised that you could get down to a number close to 70,000. But as you explained it, I mean, I believe you that can be the case. I want to expand a little bit to explain what you were saying, that that farmers are actually kind of the higher men. I mean, they are actually feeding the chickens and the pigs. Because that model is quite a bit different than it was years ago. I mean, you spent time at Iowa State, and you remember when you could go up and down the country road, and every half a mile or quarter mile, there would be a farrow to finish hog operation in the state of Iowa. And there's not so much anymore. And now they put up buildings for the right to have Tyson or JBS or somebody or Smithfield bring pigs in there for whatever segment that they're supposed to provide. But it's not really their pigs, isn't it? I mean, that they're being paid to be the caretakers, and it happens to be on their property. That's not what most people want to experience as a farmer, probably not what most people envision farming as.
Yeah. Well, what you've just described is the process of de-skilling. And I don't want to lose sight of the question that you asked around scaling back and what the farmers who are attempting to do that are learning, what's working for them. But just because you described de-skilling, this is an industrial concept. And we are talking about industrial practices being applied to agriculture. So the industrial concept of de-skilling is basically asking how you can mechanize and increase the output of a manufactured product. And so it goes back to the late 19th, early 20th century when the industrialists of that period of time discovered that you could create what today we know essentially as the assembly line, where you get folks that don't need to know anything about the final product. They just need to know about their particular part of the process, you know, that they're hooking this chain to that particular knob over there and then send it on down the conveyor line and somebody does the next hammering job and so on. So each one of those individuals is good at the particular part of the job that they do, but they need to do that job in a few seconds and they don't need anything but that particular skill. And so the intelligence of the system is no longer there with the worker. The intelligence of the system goes to the designer, and the benefits of that system redound to the people that invested the capital to set up the entire enterprise to begin with. Well, that's what's happened in farming. And the rationale has been that, well, therefore, you can generate much more output, it's much more efficient, and therefore all of us have the benefit that we can go about studying to be doctors and scientists and don't have to worry about our food. We just pay somebody else to do that for us. And there's so much that is obscured by that image. So these de-skilled farmers know exactly what's happened to them.
So what is the word you're using? You're describing that the type of farmer?
De-skilling.
De-skilling. Yeah, I was struggling with that, and I thought, oh, you should know that. But I imagine there's some other people listening that were kind of wondering, too, what's he talking about? But de-skilling, okay.
Yeah, it's basically, it's a good thing that you're asking for that clarification, because it's the word skill, and it basically says that what you're doing is degrading the skill of a worker, that you don't need, say, the craftsman that knows how to do everything from selecting the block of wood to creating the pieces that then go together to make the rocking chair and then, you know, lovingly, you know, waxes it and gives you this unique crafted piece. All that you need now is somebody that does their bit of sanding what they don't even know is going to be a part of the armchair, you know, and so they just need to do their 1 second part of the assembly process. And the just to follow, since you've asked it, the exchange there is that while the craftsman might be able to generate one good rocking chair that's just a collector's piece in maybe about 5 days, that with the assembly line method populated with de-skilled workers, they might be able to churn out 1,000 of those things in a day in a well-equipped factory, and that goes all over the planet. So we've applied that rationale to agriculture. And as I've said, that rationale is all around efficiency. So let me, I seem to be going off on tangents here, but just because you raised that, let me give you a metaphor for interpreting what has happened, because it may seem like there's nothing wrong with the scenario that I described. After all, if you generate more output, if you make this more affordable, if you make it more plentiful, that's all to the good, particularly when we're talking about food. And that's the mirage of what I would call the public relations segment of the agribusiness sector. So what I'm going to describe to you actually comes from a study that was conducted by the National Academy of Sciences, I want to say in 2013, 2014, somewhere around there. I can send you the link after we get done. But the title is something along the lines of how you assess agricultural systems. And the lesson that I learned when I read that is that you wouldn't gauge the quality of a car or your experience driving a car if you got into the driver's seat and you pushed down on the accelerator and you looked at the dashboard and you saw that you could watch the speed gauge on there. And the more you pressed on the accelerator, the more you pushed that speedometer to the right. So you might have a great experience going down the freeway, discovering how fast that thing could go, but there's other dials on that dashboard. You need to make sure, for instance, that your oil pressure is right. Mm-hmm. If you've got one of the modern electronic dashboards, it may even give you information about the tire pressure on your vehicle. in order for you to have the best experience with that vehicle over the lifetime of the vehicle, there's lots of things that you need to be monitoring simultaneously. So when we talk about the vaunted productivity and ostensive efficiency of the modern agricultural system, what we're doing is looking at the speedometer. And we're not paying attention to things such as the OGAs. For instance, we can say we're producing these many millions and these many people are being fed with sugary cereal because of this industry. But we're overlooking that that comes at the cost of polluting the Midwest, of emitting nitrous oxide into the atmosphere. I'm just restricting myself to what you do when you're producing cereals in the Midwest. And the description would be different depending on what crop we're talking about. But these days, when you look to the large production basins of agriculture, it isn't just the grains and the commodities that are coming off of that. People should know that those places have become unlivable. There are places where if you complain about the air quality in California right now due to the fires, you have similar conditions that have to do with basically pollution from animal production in very concentrated settings in some parts of the Midwest, where the water is no longer safe, where whole states have become essentially septic tanks because of the fact that the volume of manure that is being generated, which cannot be managed at the volume that's being generated, basically sits in ponds in stacks from which the news du jour in the Midwest is that there's been a leak and surface water gets polluted. So from mismanagement to fertilizers, and you know, that would be one of the gauges that you would be monitoring if you were looking at all of the dashboard gauges, because we don't value that because people see that as a cost or there's no accountability at all of what's happening to the environment. Then you have an incomplete assessment of the so-called efficiency of the system when you don't take into account everything that it's doing and you just focused on how much grain is being generated.
That makes sense. Boy, there's a lot to ponder there. You know, Ricardo, it's just like we could take any one of these segments and go on and on about it. But one part extension I'd like to add, though, you were talking about de-skilling, and this is my word for the day. You know, you've really given me something new for my vocabulary, and I'm just keep thinking about that idea because it does make so much sense when, you know, when you're saying, okay, you do this part, you do that part. So they break up the whole chain of producing hogs or chickens or something. And so one person will get the contract to raise the pigs. The next one, when they wean them, they'll take them to the next stage and they finish them somewhere else and they bring them on trucks. And, you know, the farmer gets a check for keeping them at his place and, you know, keeping track of it and so forth.
Yes, I see people, first of all, realizing the situation that they're in and doing what they can to reskill. Because in the market economy in which we exist, the way that you're able to garner more profit is to add more value where you are in your segment of the food system. And that's the key. You have to start there. So, you know, I had a farmer in Northeast Iowa several years ago, late 80s, who actually sensitized me to this at the time that he was considering whether he would adopt GMOs. He was not thinking about the safety concerns that you might imagine. He was actually just realizing that what that meant was that more of the value add was going to go away from him because these were going to be expensive. And the way that he put it to me was, you know, it used to be that in farming, you leveraged somebody else's money to make a living. So he meant you would go to the bank in the fall, you know, buy your seeds and your fertilizer, plant your crop the next spring, and when you harvest it, you pay back your banker. Now you just need to know enough to buy the whole package of production. And that's essentially the trend. You can see a future. As a matter of fact, you just need to open almost any farm magazine these days, and you see the future laid out where there are no people, and that's portrayed as progress. When you extrapolate, that's the tail end of this cult of efficiency that doesn't factor other important things in, you know, in that metaphor of the dashboard that I was describing to you earlier. So what you see there is an image of a driverless tractor that's actually controlled by a GPS system that's connected to algorithms in the computer that is not even the farm, could be in Chicago or the other side of the world. And what that computer is doing to drive its algorithms, it's comparing historical records of the productivity on that same farm. It's comparing against projected weather patterns. It's running models on what the probability that a disease is going to hit and so on. All of this might as well be a video game, you know, to some operator at some distance from the farm. And what a different world you would have if the constraint were not, let's get as much return to the capital that we're investing to generate all of this high tech, and instead said, why don't we design this whole system so that our priority is farmer first? How many communities can we keep throughout the entire rural area of the United States? Rather than operating on the model that I've just described, which essentially says human beings don't matter. If we become so efficient that essentially they're no longer necessary, let's just chalk that up to progress. That's essentially the American way. So that's the argument that has actually allowed us to create this miserable reality that doesn't value farmers, you know, where farmers are not able to make a living, where we exploit farm workers in the way that I've described. And the only people that go laughing all the way to the bank are, as you said, JBS in Brazil, Smithfield in China, Tyson here in the United States. So you first of all need to be aware of the system that you're a part of. And one easy way to remember it, I call it the Nike food system, because we're just expected to eat it, not to ask questions about how that stuff is generated. So don't just accept that you should just eat it. Ask questions about it. And realize that when you pay into the system, you're paying for more than just the hamburger or the tomato that you're buying. You're actually paying either for the livelihood or the lack thereof of everybody that's involved in getting that edible bite to your plate. So if that's worth something to you, then you want to think about where that money that you're expending for your food is going to end up. I actually think that it's scandalous that we appear to brag about how little we pay out of our disposable income for food. It oscillates right now between 8 and 10% of our disposable income. And that to me is no bragging matter. That is essentially saying we're going to cut out as many costs as possible. We're going to externalize polluting the environment. We're going to externalize paying as little as we can to farm workers. We're going to exploit immigrant farm workers. We're going to do everything we can to cut corners to build up the balance sheet. So I don't want to be a part of that kind of food system. I want to pay a fair price for what I'm eating if I know that it's going to go to keep a family on a farm, that it's going to go to provide dignified livelihood to workers, and it's going to go to clean water, clean air, and building up soil. So those kinds of folks are around. That I can't point you to a system that is wholly in place that is working in this more idealized version, because right now the agricultural system, when you compare the industrial and the alternatives that exist, is unfair. It's sort of like saying, let's race down the track 100 yards and see who's fastest, but I'm going to hobble you, you know, by tying you up in a potato sack, because what I value is high productivity. So by definition, if you're not, you know, producing the highest bushels per acre, and that's what I'm measuring, then no matter what else you do, you must be highly inefficient, and I don't value that. So we're not seeing all the other things that need to be of value, and that's what needs to change. We need to see all those things, value them, put a price on them, and then make sure that our money ends up in the things that we actually value.
You know, you made me think of something back when you were mentioning like Nike and sourcing, because I know somebody that worked on Nike on when they were trying to say, look, we need to pay attention on where you're sourcing and what the working conditions are and so forth. And a lot of companies were doing that. Certainly clothing and shoes and others, that they started going around the world and checking to see how workers were treated and so forth. And we're beginning to see more and more of that with food companies, including companies I know you're very familiar with, that are deciding that they need to have with their farm suppliers, that they're looking at them being sustainable, looking at the farming practices, looking at where they're sourcing, because their consumers are saying, tell me about the farmers. Are you exploiting the farmers, or what are they doing to the environment? I don't know how far they're getting in trying to get the prices up necessarily for the farms, but they certainly are seeming to get that environmental message passed all the way through, so that the branded products are able to say to their customers, their consumers, that look, our farmers are doing a good job. We're encouraging them to do a good job. We're working with farmers that are trying to take care of the environment.
Yeah, you know, it stands to reason. We expect those sorts of things when we go buy electronics and clothing, things of that sort. And because the food system, as I've described it, is thoroughly industrialized, then we should have those same expectations that you should be able to certify the way that you're actually generating what the industry sees as product, what we call food when we see it in the grocery store or the restaurant. So those sorts of systems should be encouraged. And more importantly, we should all realize that that's going to cost, and we should not see that as a disadvantage. We should not call that elitist. All of the things that I described imply more cost. So for instance, if we're no longer going to externalize polluting the environment, then we're talking about the fact we're going to include what it costs to keep water clean and air clean and rebuild soil into the price of our food. And if that really is important to us, we will pay for it. The way that, you know, millions of people around the planet thought nothing of going from paying $150 for a feature phone to paying $1,000 for a smartphone because there was value in it. So if there's value in making sure that you're not exploiting people or nature, then we should be willing to pay for that. Because otherwise, we put the food system into the conundrum of expecting that it sells us the cheapest value and doesn't cause any harm in terms of generating, you know, the junk food that, that it delivers. If we want quality, then we need to pay for quality. And so that applies across the board, and there need to be certification programs. And many of those, as you've said, Roger, are coming into existence. Now, they're fragmentary because the certifications that exist will certify particular segments of the value chain. So, for instance, the best known certification program that people will know is that something has been produced organically. I'm all for that, but you can produce organically and still exploit people. So then we need the certification around how well farmers were treated. So the Fair Food Program that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers will certify that part, for instance, for the crops that, that they operate in. So eventually we should have the entire value chain covered by those certifications so that you know what you're buying. The system is so complex that none of us can go to the Portlandia extreme, you know, of actually going to see where the chicken was grown. So we need these programs the same way that we expect those validations and those certifications for every other aspect of industrial life that we participate in.
How do you feel about this next step? Where do you see this, the action step, I think, for you, where you think you're going to be putting your attention? And I think the follow-up question on that is going to be, what can the average person do? What can a consumer do to, or and a voter, to support the kind of directions that you're working on?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question, Roger. So, you know, in turn, let me start out with what we're doing at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and then I'll work through what everyone else can do. So one of the things that we're doing is exemplifying what I described to you as putting the farmer first. So farmers can't be altruists in this system, and they can't be continue to be seen as the chumps of the system that essentially accept the risk, have no power, can't negotiate fair prices, don't have a fair floor price for what they produce. And one of the ways that that can be brought into being is to provide ways in which they can earn more by providing more value. And so that's making visible what they can do to deal with what today's market is demanding. So if we want to deal with such threats as, for instance, climate change, which is all around reversing the emissions of greenhouse gases, farmers, by virtue of the fact that there are over 800 million acres of farmland in the United States, can put a lot of practices into place, or a lot of perennial vegetation into place, can practice a lot of what these days are being called healthy soil practices that will help us to sequester carbon and keep carbon in place. So that's just one example of what they need a market for, or they need government programs to help support. So we are working on policies at the state level, for instance, in the state of Iowa, and at the federal level, there's a model bill that is being advanced by Representative Pingree that are all intended to support farmers to respond to what we're asking them to do. But of course, this needs to remunerate them. So that's the key thing. Farmer first. They need to be paid for what we ask them to do, and they can do a lot to help clean up the air, clean up water, build up healthy soils, and so on. because there's no question that they can produce corn to bury us all, so that we've got more than enough corn. That's not what they need to be paid for right now. Let's recognize the reality that we're in right now. So we need to update policies. We've got policies that in some cases were created in the 1960s and haven't been updated to what we require now. Some cases, you know, I'd argue, and we don't have the time for it right now, that we're behaving as if it were still the 1600s when it comes to agriculture. So what we're doing is working primarily on policy reform to make it so that there are programs that allow farmers to respond to the things that we, the rest of society, are asking them to do without asking them to be heroes. Now, in line with that, I'm also part of an initiative which is headed by a global organization, which is the International Panel of Experts in Sustainable Food. There are several U.S.-based members of this panel. I'm one. Raj Patel is another one that many of your listeners may know. Molly Anderson is another. Steve Gleisman is another. Phil Howard, and so on. And what we're doing with this group is convening leaders of agricultural organizations from around the country to basically open up a new conversation to get us away from the conventional warm tracks of getting marginal gains out of the farm bill, which is controlled by status quo and currently political ascendant organizations within agribusiness. Which means implicitly we'll not only have to have better ideas, it also means that we'll need to have numbers, because agribusiness has the political power because they have money. That's what their power derives from. And the only way we can out-leverage that is culture, you know, popular demand. So we need to work on that. So this particular podcast is one way of doing that, you know, helping people to realize the system that they're a part of and to demand a different system that eventually manifests in policy. So Union of Concerned Scientists is all around those two things, changing policies and building the political power so that it's feasible to change policies. Now, what people can do is to become far more educated about the food choices that they can make. So this is not just about the individual choice that you make, say, to be vegan or vegetarian. It's about the policies and the business models that you support, because that's the infrastructure that's invisible that creates the choices that we believe we have. So when you walk into certain establishments, I'll just use the easy target here, fast food places, those folks are not cheating you. They're actually selling you quite a bit of value. They're selling you convenience and they're saving you time. Just think about what the total cost is of that system. It is one of the major generators of climate pollution, because if they're selling you, grain production, and if they're selling you beef, then the dominant industrial methods of producing right now contribute to greenhouse gas emission. They are also part of that system that exploits people. So you don't want to support those sorts of establishments. You want to support the sorts of establishments that not only sell you stuff that is going to make you healthy, it's also going to help everybody in their value chain to thrive. So look for those kinds of establishments. So here in the DC area, I can speak to you authoritatively about what some of those places are. There's a marvelous business here that's called Little Sesame that is attempting to hit every one of the checks that I've just described to you, and being very successful about it, demonstrating proof of concept. In California, you're in one of the hotbeds of innovation for this, and so their people shouldn't have difficulty doing that. And even in places where you think this is very unlikely, one of the most successful farm families that I know is the Rosman family that farms in Northwest Iowa. They've been farming organically for 4 decades. And let me just make a little parenthesis and tell you just one little indicator of how well they understand what they're doing. This is a family that beats the county average for corn yields, and yet they haven't applied nitrogen fertilizer, purchased nitrogen fertilizer in 40 years. So, you know, they know what they're doing. This is not pixie dust that they're applying. Well, that family is supporting 4 families. So, you know, two generations, the original family and then 3 of their children on 600 acres. It was just unheard of, you know, with the economies of scale in the Midwest. And the reason why they do that is that they retain as much of the value within their system. In other words, they don't produce the corn to sell the corn. They produce the organic corn to fatten their naturally raised beef. And then it's those beef that they sell off the farm. And they grow higher value fruits and vegetables, which you can do in Iowa. And they sell all of that to a farm store that's on their property. And so because of the fact that they're retaining the value on their farm as much as possible, meaning they're minimizing the cost for purchased inputs, and then they're selling the higher margin product, you know, the meat rather than the grain, then they're able to support four families on 600 acres. So you need to find those places. If you can find them in Harlan, Iowa, you know, essentially the belly of the beast of industrial agriculture, you can find them in all parts of the United States. So seek them out. If the sorts of things we're talking about here matter to you, seek them out, reward them. And don't forget that that's not the entire battle. That what you need to do is to support the business models and the federal policies that create the realities from which all of us choose as eaters and from which farmers themselves choose in terms of the business models and the value chains that they can be a part of.
Well, I'll tell you, if people had listened to all of our conversation, I think it includes people that these things matter to them for sure. And if they want to find more information, perhaps your own website or any place else you would suggest, where would you direct people online?
Yeah, you can come to our website. The short of it is, if you remember, we're the Union of Concerned Scientists. It's ucsusa.org/food. That will get us to our website. And from there, you can branch out to lots of other resources. We're a proud member, UCS, of the Huel Food Alliance. That's an acronym that stands for Health, Environment, Agriculture, and Labor. There are over 50 of us that are members of this organization, and collectively we've created a platform for a real food system. So if you go to the healfoodalliance.org website, then you'll see that platform for real food, H-E-A-L,
Heal
Food Alliance.
I just think someday, Ricardo, you're going to change your name to the Union of Relieved Scientists. From concern.
Let's hope so.
Yeah.
Union of Fulfilled Scientists.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to dodge a bullet with all that we're going through. And that's another, we'll have more conversations because there's so much to tackle. And as usual, you've given me a lot to think about. And I think a lot of listeners are grateful too for the work that you're doing. And I'm grateful for your taking the time to being with me on Farm to Table Talk.
You're very generous, Roger. I always learn a lot. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.